The following podcast includes adult language and mature themes. Listener discretion is advised. Amazing. Writer-artist Howard Chaykin apprenticed under such titans as Gil Kane, Wally Wood, and Neil Adams before breaking into comics in the early 70s. Disinterested in the dominant superhero and horror genres of the time, Chaykin became a one-man pulp hero renaissance with period, fantasy, and sci-fi work across numerous publishers, and was the original artist of Marvel Comics' Star Wars adaptation. In 1983, he began his magnum opus, American Flag, an alarmingly prescient look at a near future where countries are owned and operated by corporations, and culture is dominated by reality TV stars. Chaykin defined adult comics in the 1980s with his heady mix of sexual imagery, mature socio-political themes, ultra-violence, and challenging Altman-esque storytelling that swore off exposition and other typical narrative tools in favor of more ambiguous, dialogue-driven tales. Chaykin became something of a poster boy for bold new directions that took old-timey characters like The Shadow, Black Hawk, and DC's stable of lesser Silver Age science fantasy protagonists and served them rails of coke off a hooker's ass through a peppermint straw. Chaykin largely left comics for a number of years to pursue work in television and film, but returned in the 21st century for more daring work at publishers like Vertigo and Image, including a revival of his cult hit pornographic horror title Black Kiss. Of all the comic creators I've interacted with, none intimidated me more than Howard Chaykin, known for his quick, caustic wit and intolerance of fools. I felt like an idiot asking a jazz and martini man about hoary old kiddie fare like 1950s Martian Manhunter comics. So I was shocked to find Chaykin warm, welcoming, and conspiratorial as he let me sit beside him and watch him flirt with pretty girls and explain the structure of his retirement plan through the Screenwriters Guild of America. The creator I was most afraid to approach gave me one of my absolute favorite interview experiences, and after I tucked his dapper business card into my wallet, it somehow lingered there for nearly a year, making me happy each time I spied it.
Okay, I'm here with Howard Chaykin. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I talked to you yesterday, and you mentioned that you were a comic book fan from early on, dating back to the 1950s. That's right?
Oh, absolutely. I come out of the Silver Age. I mean, I discovered comics when I was four, but what really kicked into stride was with the Julie Schwartz stuff. All of Julie's books, I'd read all the Superman and Batman stuff out front, of course, but when Julie came along and started doing, you know, The Flash, Green Lantern, you know, The Atom, all that stuff, Hawkman, that stuff just killed me. I really loved that work. And when I became a Golden Age collector years later, and finding out the precedence of those things, it deepened and enriched my feelings for that work enormously.
Now, I also understand, too, you were reading Detective Comics with John Jones at the time, correct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I became a Golden Age collector, among my primary goals was to develop extended runs of Detective. The Batman stuff that was in Detective Comics in the 40s and early 50s was some of the best material that Dick Sprang had ever done, before he became really abstract and lost. And back then, there was a backup feature called Airwave, which was one of the funniest, silliest comic books ever. When I discovered John Jones' Manhunter from Mars, I thought there was something kind of oddly, I hate to use the word meta about it, but it seemed to be aware of how odd it was, both in the drawing style and in the writing. I tried really hard not to pronounce his Martian name as Jones, but it seemed a mountain I couldn't climb, if you will. You know, it had to be Johns or something, but no, it was Jones. You know what I mean?
I tend to agree with you. When you read a lot of that stuff in a run, you realize that these guys were doing the job, and they were just kind of knocking it out every month, but they were seeming to have fun with it as well. So it wasn't as self-serious as some of the books were, especially these days.
Well, I think in those days, most of these, you have to remember that the guys who were doing comic books back in those days were the children of the Depression. You know, one of the things that my generation didn't really realize until we reached a certain age was the shitstorm those cats lived through. I mean, the 1930s, the hand-to-mouth existence of that, and then just when things begin to seem to be getting better, the Second World War begins. So you're talking, you know, about, you know, literally 14, 15 years of a complete shitstorm. So that the silence and low keyness of the 1950s, that kind of generation of silence, that stolidity, is utterly justified and understandable. And that worked, and that doesn't really start changing until the early 60s. But that 50s stuff, I mean, I loved it. It was just crazy stuff. I mean, for me, it always makes me think of summer. And you know, in those days, it wasn't comic book stores. It was candy stores and drug stores. And, you know, the combination of penny candy and a comic book was just what it defined my childhood in so many ways, and so deeply and so profoundly.
So did you enjoy the strip more when they were doing the more the weird detective type stories before they got into the more superhero type stuff?
I really dug the weird detective shit. I mean, along with Roy Raymond TV Detective as well by Ruben Moreira, that stuff was just wacky, you know? I really was crazy for that stuff. I really did. You know?
You spoke a little bit about the creative team yesterday. Did you actually have any insights on the creative team?
Not at all. I became a professional, you know, doing work under my own name in 71 or so. And by that time, those guys were long gone. The guys I met when I was first coming in, besides my mentors, you know, Neil introduced me to Murphy Anderson, who he shared a workspace with at DC in those days. Murphy ran a coffee shop, you know, like he sold coffee out of a pot in the office. You know, throw money in a can and keep it supported. And Murphy was just a great guy. And you know, I met all the guys who lived, but those guys were gone. But I always thought that there was a measure of self-awareness going on in John Jones that reflected an understanding of the inanity of the material. You know, and of course, as comics have gone on, what you've got is material created by and for 15-year-old boys, slathered with a level of an air of gravitas to make it palatable to the guys who are reading it at 15. So all of a sudden, John Jones has all this tragic backstory and all this other stuff. And back then, it was just some goofy ass shit, you know.
See, for me, the strip takes an uptick in joy when Zook shows up, and there's a lot of people who just can't handle the little.
I'm afraid I'm with those people. I hated that shit.
Just too far the other way, huh?
I mean, it was just. I mean, clearly, this was not the House of Idea. You know, I mean, this was no. It was dumbass shit. I mean, even for me, as a self-serious 11-year-old, it was just too much to bear.
Well, it didn't help too.
Doug Batmite, and I love Mr. Mixies Patelic.
I guess
not
it's
bad, huh?
No, not bad. Also, too, by then you'd discover Marvel, so it's the comparison's going to be wrong.
I mean, the thing about, I became a Marvel guy officially. I mean, I read all this stuff, and I discovered them. I guess Spider-Man 3 had come out, and there was an issue of Sergeant Fury, where Sergeant Fury says, "Okay, you told me that. What do you want to do? Give you a kiss?" I thought this was as close as you can get to Noel Coward in comics. I mean, I was ready to go. This is the funniest shit I'd ever read. It was like fantastic. And, you know, characters yelling at each other. It was like his home. You know, it was fantastic. So by that time, I sort of lost my taste for a lot of the DC stuff.
Well, you're talking about Stan being funny. I've just recently discovered his old Patsy Walker and Patsy and Hetty comics, and I'm finding those to be a real hoot.
Well, I read those when I was a little boy. You know, because they were part of this whole pile of comics that my cousins gave me, which turned me on to comics in the first place. So I was aware of that stuff, you know, and to a certain extent, there's a measure of eroticism in a lot of that early stuff that can't be discounted or denied. You know, I mean, the Katie Keene stuff. I remember as a summer camp counselor taking Katie Keene comics away from my campers who were jerking off over them. You know, they'd gotten them from the girls' bunks. You know, I was like, what the fuck? You know? Back to you.
Thank you very much. You haven't written John Jones in the quote-unquote canon DC very often, but you're one of the best guys about including him in your Elseworlds, your imaginary stories, Son of Superman, Superman Distant Fires. I think he was in Secret Society of Superheroes as well. Is there a reason why he keeps creeping into your books besides just, you know, the familiarity from youth?
No, I think one of the things about the DC universe is that there are characters that are fun to service. You know, and I said earlier to somebody that I felt that my writing in television had directly affected in a very positive way the way I write comics. And to a great extent, one of the things about that is, you know, when you're working on a show that's got a multiple cast, one of your jobs is to service your cast. And the realm of possibility that's available to you in the DC comic universe is such that you can achieve certain goals by servicing certain characters and using them for service and both answering their value. So, you know, I think there are certain iconic characters that belong in everything. You gotta have them. You know, that's really as simple as that. No more complex than that.
Well, I mean, hell, you call John Jones iconic. That's more than most people would give him.
But I think he is iconic to a certain generation. I think, I mean, it's just...
It's interesting because you have this lag, because the kids of the 50s and 60s who grew up with him as a member of the Justice League, as one of the Magnificent Seven, hold him dear to them. And then kids of my generation, the Bronze Age, or the late Bronze Age kids who saw him when he came back to the Justice League and was part of Justice League International, we hold him dear. And also the kids who grew up on the cartoons of the early 2000s. But there's this gap period from like the late 60s and the 70s where those creators just seem to not have much interest in the character.
Well, I think it's more a nostalgic sense memory. I mean, I think there's an element of significance attached to the fact that, you may not remember this, but there was that abortive Justice League pilot many years ago. You ever seen it?
Right. Oh, yeah, David Ogden Stiers, right?
That's what I'm saying. Think about that. David Ogden Stiers playing John Jones, Man on Mars. That's kind of nutty.
He had a good voice, though.
Yeah, well, he has a great voice. He has the perfect radio voice, you know.
I mean, not the perfect body for latex, though.
So I think, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, some out there of my generation, before they die, is going to bring back Kangorilla.
Oh, it's already happened. James Robinson, in fact.
See, and James is the guy, always, you know, because he's the guy who's deeply steeped in that background tradition. And that's a perfect idea. It really is. I mean, I know Stuart Schreck over at DC is obsessed with Airwave, you know, so sooner or later it's going to pop back up. You know it. All that stuff. I mean, you know, Zatara, Zatanna, you know, you say tomato and I say tomato. It's really, you know, you go dig into the canon. And at Marvel, it's very much the same way, same circumstance in a different way. I mean, Marvel, as I've said more than once, is the archetype of using everything of the pig, including the squeal. And I respect that deeply. I mean, they're gonna find a way to exploit and maximize use of anything they own. And I think that's exactly the way to work and function. I really do.
Speaking of James Robinson, we talked yesterday about how he had done the Golden Age miniseries with Paul Smith. That had gone over well. You pretty much volunteered, hey, if you do Silver Age, I want to do it. And you told me a little bit about having developed that property with him. Would we willing to discuss that a little bit?
It was a really great concept. The timing out of the situation seemed to just devolve. And by the time it all got together, it sort of melted away. And then, of course, Darwin Cook has really done it with New Frontier. I think Darwin loves the material more than I do, and I think more than James does, in a way that's more identifiable as love, as opposed to appreciation and exploration. I mean, I love New Frontier. I thought it was just bitchin'. You know, my take on the Silver Age, and I think James as well, would have been much darker than it looked at a world that was much less optimistic.
I'd have to agree. With the Golden Age books were a little darker, a little more weird, psycho stuff going on in them because people were still figuring out the medium.
I loved it. I mean, I wrote the intro to the trade paperback, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, and I think that the Golden Age characters work well when you dig them up and do, you know, more sophisticated stuff with them. With the Golden Age, it's almost like an eternal childhood. You kind of want to preserve the innocence of those characters.
No.
Well, not you, but some other guy.
I think
you're the guy who did Twilight, for God's sake.
Well, and again, I work in a field in which you really do have 50-year-old men reading the same thing they read when they were 15, and I'm one of those guys. You know, I mean, I grew up reading those, like I say, all those Julie Schwartz science fiction books, you know, the Atomic Knights, Space Museum, all that stuff. Space Cabby, Star Hawkins, love that work. And having the opportunity to do that, you know, these characters were moribund at that point, and there was an opportunity to reinvent. Look, Alan sets the pace with that. I mean, let's not forget that Watchmen was originally based on the Charlton characters, which had been acquired by DC. And they decided that they didn't want to throw those characters away in that particular direction, so we invented new ones. And Twilight really does the same thing with those characters. And typically, there's always buyer's remorse at these companies when this sort of stuff happens. And then you give it a year or two, and it can be ignored. So, you know, it's just another universe.
See, this is the thing, though. The audience is different now. You're not writing for the 12-year-old boys anymore. You're really writing for the guys who've been growing up with this stuff for decades. You're writing for a lot more of adults, and you have to give adults something adult to get their teeth into.
But among those 40 to 50-year-old men, there are juvenilists. There are people who like a darker, edgier take on stuff that goes back to their childhood. And there are people who feel they've outgrown this material and are looking in different directions. So it's a much more splintered, shattered audience. Okay? And it's difficult to satisfy the entire audience with everything. You know? And you're also dealing with an audience that has a kind of an odd dichotomous relationship with the concept of is it popular because it's good, or is it good because it's popular? You know? You don't know.
One last question, too. So you didn't get to do The Silver Age. Was there anything that you wanted to do with John Jones in that context that you didn't get the chance to do, or did it really not get that far?
Not really. No. I mean, it's because the thing about both Golden Age and what Silver Age might have been is you're dealing with an ensemble. And I think the ensemble effect, the nature of that, is what it's about. That's really where it's at for me. So, but thanks.
Yes, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. Great talking with you.
Hey, everybody, I'm Joe.
And I'm Sean.
And we have a pro wrestling podcast we want to tell you about. It's called I Could Talk Kayfabe.
That's right. We're looking at the wrestling magazines from the 70s, 80s, and 90s, breaking them down and having some fun.
Do you want to know who was the number one rated wrestler in March of 1986?
Do you want to know why Rick Rude is wrestling the Ultimate Warrior all wrong?
Maybe you want to hear about a brutal ladder match between Colonel DeBeers and Scott Hall.
Or how about an interview with Mike Rotundo? There's a lot of them.
And lots of cool photos of Butch Reed and Al Perez.
Check us out wherever you get your podcasts, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Apple Podcasts. Rate, subscribe, and tell a friend.
You pencil neck geek.
As Art Adams was to X-Men annuals at Marvel, Mike McCone was to Justice League and Legion ones at DC. His crisp, hyper-detailed style was too effort-intensive to support a monthly grind, so instead he would do a handful of extended-length specials each year that through his virtues actually felt special as an asset rather than just as a publishing designation. McCone has managed some extended runs on titles like Amazing Spider-Man, Exiles, Justice League United, Magnus Robot Fighter, Spartan, Vexed, and They're All a Treat.
You spent much of your early career drawing Martian Manhunter and various Justice League projects. Did you have fun with that?
I did. It was my first professional work. So I was 19 years old, loved comics, totally unjaded, which is kind of the opposite of how I am now. So I enjoyed it a lot. Even though I wasn't a DC fan, I was a Marvel fan. But DC were paying me, so.
That being the case, did you have any prior experience with the Justice League? Like, as a reader?
No, none at all. None at all. I don't think I'd even read a Justice League comic outside of the Kevin Maguire, Mark DeMatteis Justice League. But I was reading that for the creators, not for the characters. I was totally unfamiliar with them.
Have you gone back and read any material since then?
No.
Did you enjoy drawing the Martian Manhunter specifically?
I've got to say, I enjoy the character, but I don't really enjoy drawing him. Because I don't think I draw him very well.
I would definitely disagree. You're actually one of my favorite Martian Manhunter artists.
Well, I appreciate it. It's very kind of you to say so. But he was just one of those characters that I never felt like I was able to just kind of key into who he was. The Blue Beetle, I knew immediately how I thought he should look. Batman, you know, characters like that. But some characters just don't seem to work for me. And that's generally no reflection on how they do look when I draw them. It's just how it feels to me. And I don't think I got them right, really, until I drew Justice League United last year.
Yeah, and your take on the character has evolved quite a bit because he was a really big, muscular character when you first started doing him. And now he looks a bit more sleek. There's more of a sci-fi feel to him in the newer work.
Yeah, I think that was when I was drawing the book initially 25 years ago. I was a big Alan Davis fan, and he used to draw these just incredibly large shoulders on characters and with these ridiculously thin waists, and I think I was going after that a little bit. But I've slimmed him down quite a bit, as I have with Superman, too. Yeah, I don't really like drawing them too bulkily anymore.
Yeah, I remember you had a really massive Superman back in the day as well.
It was utterly ludicrous. I don't know why I drew him that large. So hopefully with hindsight, you know, and a little more experience. I do it a little better now.
Now, it's the 60th anniversary of the Martian Manhunter this year. You've actually drawn the character fairly consistently in the sense of, like, when you've had a run on a book, he's often popped up in the DC titles. Do you have any affection for the character just as a character, as a reader?
Well, I do like the character. He seems to be, I guess if I likened him to anyone at Marvel, it would be the Vision. Incredibly powerful character who isn't a hothead, is a kind of lead character, so he's a little more interesting in that. His take on you know, crime fighting or justice is a little more detached, which I always find kind of interesting, especially since I've moved to America. My own views on kind of the legal system and crime and punishment in the U.S. is kind of detached because I'm a foreigner here. So I guess there are parallels in that sense.
Thank you very much for your time, sir. It was great talking with you.
It began with the origin of his comic book fandom.
This is the very first comic book I have ever read, and also ignited the spark of my comic book collecting over the course of a 1974 weekend.
Professor Zoom Yukinori led an ongoing expedition through his favorite single-issue comic book stories from the Bronze Age of DC Comics.
Balance of Power, Have Horse, Will Fly, Solomon Grundy, Wins on a Monday, Superman's Unbeatable Rival, Green Lantern, Master Criminal of the 25th Century.
With unique celebrity guest perspectives in an ambitious attempt to set this program apart from other comic book review podcasts.
Call me Terror Man. Solomon Grundy am co-host this time.
I am Lanos, the lexical archive of minutiae, expositions, and origins.
Goodbye, me am Bizarro.
I am Libra.
This is Aya from the Green Lantern.
It is I, the Reverse Flash.
Which had ended with the destruction of the universe. Or has it? Warrant Underation are we?
I regret to say that you are my prisoner.
Without our interspatial time conveyor, we are all essentially trapped here.
Can't summon the willpower necessary for my power ring to pull me free.
For nearly two decades, I had carried her ghost within my heart.
Experience the wonder.
Great wings of Mercury!
Of an all-new season.
Solomon Grundy, fat, little pointy-eared man before.
Let us get back to the story, shall we?
Down, down. And approach
of the Done in One Wonders podcast Wonder Show. Only on the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Allow me, Entity Terra Man.
That does it. They ain't messing with no timing lines ever again.
Carlo Barberi is an underappreciated Amerimanga, or I suppose Mexamanga, artist, best known for his work on titles including Deadpool, Spider-Man, Impulse, Gen 13, and X-Men.
How many years did you work on the Justice League animated comic book, the adaptation?
Oh, yeah. I did that in DC about 7 years ago or something like that.
How many years did you work on it?
Like three years, yeah.
Did you get to work with any of the people involved with the animated show, or did they basically leave you to your own devices?
No, I work, it's a separate thing. The writers, they wrote some cartoons on some issues, and it was fun to work with them.
Did you have any particular favorite writers you liked working with?
Well, no, I'm happy with the guys who I've been working. Yeah, they're. I like the way they do things. I've been happy. The last thing I did with this amazing Spider-Man was with Jerry Conway, so he's a legend, so I was really happy. And drawing Spider-Man, awesome.
Did you ever watch the animated series yourself?
Oh, yeah, a lot. I actually got a lot of reference from there. It was. I tried to be as accurate to the cartoon as I could be. I bought all the DVDs and all, so I have it all.
I liked how you were able to adapt the Bruce Timm style. You had that basic look, but you gave it your own feel, your own kind of curves. It was like a nice smooth line and everything. Did you have any particular characters you liked working on?
Well. I don't know. I like them all. I can say one exactly. I love Spider-Man. Deadpool. I drew Deadpool for about 3 years, so that was fun. I drew Superman, Batman. I don't know. You name it.
And also, I want to make sure I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Is it Carlo Barberi?
It's Carlo Barberi.
Excellent. Thank you very much for spending time with us. Appreciate it.
Social media support for our last episode featuring Jim Starlin came from Derek William Crabb, the Rad Adventures Podcasting Network, DeBeige, 20th Century Geek, The 108th Sage, Ali Batz, Batit Shapirak, Between the Pages, Caroline Wells, Cash Flag, Cesar S. Dos Santos, Chris at Bad Books for Beginners, Chris Sheehan, Coffee and Comics, Comics in the Golden Age, Dan O., DCU Movie Page, hashtag Release the Snyder Cut, Doc Strange, Dwight L. McPherson, Ed Moore, Fanholes Podcast, Gary at Chipper Rules, Graphic Novelism, History of Comics on Film, Paul Hicks, Jim at Canada Daredevil, Joe Crawford, Keith G. Baker, Lava Hog, Martin Gray, Michelle Fife, names Anthony Joseph and I Love Alternate Comics, Odell Abner Dracula, Professor Riptide, Randy Andrews, Randy Caldwell, Secret Wars Beyond Podcast, Slang Word Resists, Stephen Sellers, Talk Dirty to Me, Trekker Talk, Unearthly Visions, Resurrections and Adam Warlock and Thanos Podcast, Warlord Worlds, Willie Yarbrough, Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast, and Xenozoic Xenophiles. Dan O. wrote, had me at Jim Starlin listening now, hashtag Marvel Cosmic, hashtag Thanos, and Odell Abner Dracula wrote, you guys just made my weekend. Shout out to Catholics and Catholic school refugees.
Do you enjoy movie scores? Do you like science fiction? Do you like fantasy? And do you like movies?
Everything's under control. Situation normal.
What happened?
Had a slight weapons malfunction, but everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Well, I have a podcast for you. Soundtrack Alley. It's a podcast where I take you on a journey through the time of my childhood and beyond to give you a glimpse into the world of movies, science fiction, fantasy, and other films that touch me on a personal level. You'll also enjoy interviews from film composers from famous movies from the past or even current times. Enjoy the interaction I have with guests on my show every so often, and check out other shows that share in guest spots. So sit back, relax, and let the soundtrack world wash over you, and check out Soundtrack Alley. You'll love it!
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Everything on the table is for sale. Lighten my load. Send you home empty-handed. Everything is marked on the back. Yes, how do we do it? Volume. Volume. Volume.